Fortress America in London, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. The U.S. opens a new billion-dollar embassy in London. We sent our reporter out to tell us more about this projection of U.S. soft power.
On the sixth floor, there is a man at a treadmill, or it might be a treadmill standing desk, running on the spot, going nowhere. So put as many symbols on that as you like.
And the Me Too movement has some Frenchmen questioning their ideas of romance.
We're playing a game, but it turns out in a lot of situations, it's very male-oriented. Like, men can do that and women can't.
Plus, in British Columbia, don't poke the bear.
Okay, everyone's going to have to be real quiet because the bear's right in front of the tower.
Some real grisly tourism coming up right here on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. It's a huge new American building. It's ultra-modern, super expensive, and it's in one of the hottest real estate markets on earth. And today, it's open for business. Just the kind of event you'd think Donald Trump would want to be part of. But the president said no to the ribbon cutting at the brand new American embassy in London. Trump explained his decision by saying the new embassy was a, quote, bad deal made by President Obama. Well, not quite. The truth is, the decision to build the new embassy was made under President George W. Bush. In any case, we sent our man in London, Leo Hornack, over to the new embassy site, or at least as close as U.S. security forces will allow. So tell me, Leo, how's it look?
Yes, Carol, I'm standing just about as close as you say. I'm standing just about as close as you can get to what I can... I think it's best to describe it as an edifice. It's absolutely huge. It's the shape of a... sort of the shape of a giant Rubik's Cube. It's like a kind of slightly awkward hybrid between maybe a luxury hotel and a medieval fortress. So from the hotel point of view, you've got this kind of soft lighting, modern front. There's an ornamental garden, which is partly open to the public. And the fortress element, well, to be honest, I can't get particularly close to it. In the garden, there is something that is really best described as a moat. Behind the elegant hedges in the ornamental garden, we know that there are blast barriers to prevent a truck bomb. It's very much the two sides of how the U.S. has to present itself.
Yeah, it sounds like it's kind of come hither, but not too close. It's kind of showing off, yet not letting anybody in.
Well, indeed. And I mean, read as many symbols into that as you want, Carol. I mean, if you also want other symbols, I'm just looking up now, and I can see on the sixth floor there is a man at a treadmill, or it might be a treadmill standing desk, running on the spot, going nowhere, working up a sweat and looking out at London. So put as many symbols on that as you like.
I know the reason given for moving in the embassy was security. Trump kind of dissed the location on Twitter after he said it was a bad deal that the old embassy was sold for peanuts, that this one, which had a billion-dollar price tag, by the way, is at an off location. Does the president have a point?
You know, he does have a point in one way. The old embassy was in a place called Mayfair, which is one of the historic parts of London. On the London Monopoly Board, it's the most expensive property in the whole of the city, just to give you a sense. And so, yes, this isn't such a historic or maybe even prestigious location, but it's still pretty close to the centre. But I think the real point here is actually what the building itself symbolises. In some ways, I don't think it's reading too much into it to say that it really had the fingerprints of the Obama era on it. I mean, this is a building that would recycle rainwater for use in the toilet system. This is a building that has photovoltaic solar panels to avoid wasting electricity so that it can support itself. It's environmentally friendly. The prize-winning architects who put it together said that their aim was a building that combined security with sustainability. And I mean, I haven't actually done a full survey on this, but I'm pretty sure that there's no... when you build a Trump Tower anywhere in the world, one of the first priorities aren't the solar panels. I don't think anyone's that surprised to find that the new president feels that this new building is not exactly the tone that he would prefer, and that maybe having a highly defended concrete building as the old one was in one of the most expensive and prestigious kind of luxury goods areas of London, maybe that would have been a bit more in keeping with the tone of the new White House.
The World's Leo Hornack speaking with me from Wandsworth in South London, site of the new U.S. Embassy. Thanks, Leo.
Thanks very much, Carol. Bye-bye.
All this talk about the billion-dollar embassy in London reminded me of the fuss about another U.S. embassy once touted as the most expensive in the world. I'm talking about the giant U.S. compound in Baghdad. It was built after the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003 to symbolize the permanence of U.S. influence in Iraq and throughout the Middle East. And in the turbulent years that followed, it became the heart of what was known as the Green Zone, which one author described as a surreal bubble of pure Americana. So whatever happened to it? Iraqi journalist Sahar Issa is in Baghdad.
The embassy is still there in that, as you said, bubble of Americana. However, of course, the embassy has changed in character. When it was built, as you said, it was supposed to be the center, the beating heart of a big American influence in Iraq and in the Middle East. But in 2011, of course, and with the withdrawal of the American forces, everything began to draw down. I think at the height, it had employed around maybe 16,000 people. These people, of course, were not all diplomatics. A large number of them were support.
How many employees there now?
It's difficult to say, less than 6,000 maybe.
Now, it's not just one building. Describe it for us.
It's a complex. It is a great big complex on, I think, 103 acres of land. Prime Baghdad real estate. I think it has four apartment blocks. It has, I think, two work locations, buildings. It has recreation. Of course, I can understand that. I think you can understand that, too. If people are going to be cooped up, I suppose they need like a swimming pool. They need a tennis court. They need gym. They need these things. So they are there. However, I have heard some people speak about reports of luxurious existence. I have never heard anyone on the local scene describe anything luxurious. But I will say that it is a great big complex. Security is double-fold, if not threefold, if not fourfold. So it's like a green zone within the green zone. It's like a state within a state, I will say.
When you were talking about the fact that it was built on prime real estate, I kind of noticed some sort of resentment in your voice.
Let me take you a little bit further back. It has always been resented during the eras that passed, like Saddam's era and the era before that and the era before that, that the rulers who come to this country seize prime property, prime real estate, and they make it their own. And the American embassy, yo and behold, is on the prime land that is on the Tigris, and that is the heart of the people who wish that they could actually walk along the embankments of the Tigris and spend the nice evenings in the breeze there. And it hurts. It hurts me as an Iraqi. It hurts a lot of people. Everyone speaks about it, and everyone is waiting to see when the situation is going to change. After all, Iraq is sovereign. And after all, there is a democratically elected government. Why is it hiding behind the walls? And why is the American embassy hiding behind the walls? What is the intention? What do they have in their hearts? Why don't they come out to the people? I am telling you what people say. This is what they say. Why are they hiding over there?
Iraqi journalist Sahar Issa, thanks so much.
You are most welcome.
The legacy of the Iraq War can be tallied in many ways, but not all are as tangible as dollars or buildings. There's also its impact on the role of the U.S. in the rest of the world. Historically, the U.S. has positioned itself as a protector and promoter of democracy and civil liberties, but that's changing in the aftermath of the Iraq War. And a new report by the U.S. government-funded think tank Freedom House says that's bad news for the rest of the world. Susan Glasser is Politico's chief international affairs columnist. I asked her how far back she traces the shift.
Well, look, I think it's accelerated undoubtedly under the presidency of Donald Trump. But I think you're right to point out that this is not a brand new phenomenon and that there's been a reaction, broadly speaking, in the American public, the American political system, really over the last decade, questioning American intervention abroad, questioning whether America can continue to play the role of the world's lone superpower in the way that it did in the 1990s in the aftermath of the end of the Cold War. And I think you see a recalibration and less support across the board for the idea of America promoting democracy, promoting human rights, promoting activism in many ways in different countries.
The authors of this report write that the most striking development they tracked this past year is, quote, the accelerating withdrawal of the United States from its historical commitment to promoting and supporting democracy. How have you seen this unfolding under this new administration?
Well, look, as I said, it's not that it's new under the Trump administration, but I think it's moved to warp speed under them in a way that I think raises profound questions about America's future role in the world. And, you know, not only is there no one in charge, basically, of human rights and democracy promotion at the State Department, but you have both a Secretary of State and a President who've essentially said it's no longer a significant factor in our foreign policy. As you know, Donald Trump has consistently expressed sympathy with and has had public kind words for authoritarian leaders of many kinds. He has gone, in fact, to Saudi Arabia on his very first trip as U.S. president last spring, you remember, and went out there and basically said, good news, America will no longer be lecturing you about your foreign policy and your human rights record. And the message that sends, of course, to a country that's defined itself in the world as this exceptional beacon of human rights and democracy promotion has been, I think, underappreciated. And it's a major shift that I think will have long-term consequences that we can't even fully anticipate.
Do you think this administration is also changing what democracy looks like in the U.S.?
Look, that is a very important finding of this Freedom House report, which is democracy backsliding here inside the United States. I think it's a finding that comports with what we've seen over the past year, which is the Trump administration and in particular the president himself questioning pillars of our democratic constitutional system, such as the independence of the media, such as the independence of the judicial branch of government. Those things are exactly the criteria that Freedom House uses to rate other countries around the world. And just applying the same standards that they are applying to other countries means the United States has gone down in the democracy rankings. And I think it's going to be correctly perceived as a significant and controversial development.
Do you see any benefits to the reorientation internationally, meaning that the U.S. is going to step back from democracy building overseas? Because many have argued that U.S. involvement in the so-called democracy struggle has really backfired in many countries overseas.
Look, it's very interesting. I think there's a ripe debate to be had here inside the United States about what kind of foreign policy orientation is the most effective and produces the results that we would most want. And I wish that we were having that. But unfortunately, instead, what's happened is that President Trump has come into office vowing to blow up existing American foreign policy, but in an entirely uncertain and unclear way. So rather than simply reorienting America's presence in the world overseas, what I see happening is more that he's offered us a very unpredictable foreign policy. It's not that he's replaced one ideological set of principles with another. I think what's happened is that he's just called into question America's commitment to the institutions and alliances that it's historically had without offering an alternative. And that's a very different thing than having that debate, which could be very healthy.
Susan Glasser with Politico. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, French men and the Me Too movement. You're with the world. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. There are a lot of cross currents swirling around the Me Too movement and the growing outcry against sexual harassment. But one thing that is clear is that conversations that might have been unimaginable a few months ago are happening now in the U.S. and around the world.
Men are talking about this for the first time. A lot of men suddenly understood that women they know, their maybe relatives, maybe their wife or girlfriend, maybe their daughters, they suddenly understood what they experience in their everyday life.
That's Nabil Wakim. He's been writing about Me Too for the French newspaper Le Monde. As part of the continuing coverage of that movement by our Across Women's Lives project, we asked Wakim about the divide between the way French and American men are responding to the movement.
One thing, and it's maybe obvious to say, is that French and American people don't feel the same way about men-woman relationship. French people are much more liberated in some ways than Americans are. And so
what do you mean by that? Because that's always like, really? Come on. What do you mean?
Yes. It's not about only being romantic and strolling down the Seine in Paris and kissing everybody you see. It's not like that. It's just that French people tend to see America as a very Puritan place, as a place where, because of political correctness, but also because America's history and because the place religion occupies in America, people are much more cautious about man-woman relationship. There's a lot of things that you can't say or can't do. And it's actually very common in France to say, we don't want to become like America. We don't want to be as cautious as they are. We want to keep our freedom in this respect. And a lot of that is based on stereotypes. And of course, the reality in both France and the US is much more complicated than that. But still, this is how people think about it, for most people, I would say.
So if the French think that Americans are kind of Puritans where love is concerned, how do the French view love and seduction?
The idea of romance in France is maybe much more about the gray zones than about consent. In French literature and the French history, in the story of how you've met your significant other, probably what you like to tell is the story of that gray zone where you don't know if people like you or not, or if they agree or not to the relationship. And there haven't been in France for years a conversation about consent. This is pretty new in France to use even the word consent in terms of male-female relationships.
When you say the gray zone, do you mean, is it the gray zone of a man interested in a woman, not sure she's interested in him, and the sort of back and forth that's going to determine that?
One way to put it is exactly what was in the op-ed by 100 women that was published in Le Monde last week. One of the women who signed this op-ed said, well, maybe if my husband didn't harass me a little bit, he wouldn't be my husband right now. There is this idea that this is how it works. There is this idea that men are annoying to women and women in their own way kind of like it.
What do you mean by annoying?
Well, I would characterize that as harassment, but I think most French men wouldn't.
So here's my next question. Does the whole French idea of seduction, can women be the seducers, or is it about men always making the moves and operating in the gray zone? Because this, to me, is a critical issue.
It is a critical issue, and I would say that the stereotype would be of the French lover would be that men can do that and women can't. So this would be maybe the big lie about it. There's some idea in France that we're not Puritan, and so we can have this kind of relationship, and it's based on freedom, and it's based on the fact that we're all grown-ups, and we can say yes, and we can say no, and we're playing a game. But it turns out, in a lot of situations, it's very male-oriented. Like, men can do that, and women can't.
Hmm. Having lived in the U.S. and living in France, any other observations about how romance or love is thought of or conducted differently? I mean, there's so many stereotypes and ideas of, oh, the French and love. And, you know, from a distance, it's like, come on. I mean, what differences do you see that are really sort of real?
I remember an American student that I knew, and she was terribly shocked by French people kissing in the subway. And she was like, wow, I would never do that in the US because you don't kiss people in the New York subways. This wouldn't happen. And at the time, it was a few years ago, I was like, whoa, these Americans are crazy. It's just how you show your significant others that you love them. And probably one of the keys is that French people like the world to know who they're with and how they seduce, how they love. And in the U.S., this is less visible.
I think the thing that intrigues me is that the whole French discussion, it seems to be how men see love and expressing themselves and pursuing. And it seems that men kind of are in charge of romance, I guess, from a distance. And so that feels retro in certain respects.
Yes, yes, yes. Absolutely. This is where we're coming from. Like, a few weeks ago, a famous magazine in France called L'Obs, and this writer wrote this story about oh, this Me Too movement is the end of the French lover as we know it. It's the end of how, you know, you can follow a woman in the street and she doesn't know she's followed, and suddenly she will turn her head and see you, and it will maybe be love at first sight. I know this sounds like a real caricature, but in a way, this is how French men think. Maybe in a way it goes back to how people think of what French identity is. They think that we eat pork and we drink wine and we seduce women in the streets. Like, for example, a few years ago, there was all this talk about Tinder and this OkCupid kind of apps saying like, hey, this is going to kill the French love, because in France, you can, you, if you're a man, you can go to a woman in the street and talk to her and seduce her. And this you can't in the U.S. And of course, this is not true, neither in France, neither in the U.S. Most French people wouldn't do that. But still, in the mindset, there is this idea that this is how you seduce people, like by being a blunt and sometimes stupid French lover caricature. I don't know.
Nabil Wakim is a reporter with Le Monde. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
A quick look ahead now to another Me Too-related story we'll have on the show tomorrow. It's about Nicole Bowen Crawford, a U.S. Army vet who served in Iraq.
There were constantly bombs going off. We never knew when we were driving to and from if we were going to run over an IED or, you know, if our lives could be over in the next minute or so. There wasn't a safe zone. So at the same time I was experiencing all of the traumas of combat, I was also going through a very layered experience with all of the traumas of sexual harassment, and not limited to one incident.
Now she's speaking out against the military culture that led to that harassment and assault. The Lady Warrior Project, coming up tomorrow. I'm Carol Hills. The battle for the Syrian city of Aleppo ended a year ago, and for some, things are finally getting back to normal.
Now I can go to the movies.
What kind of movies are playing in Aleppo?
Last week, it was The Greatest Showman. It was Hugh Jackman. I like him so much, so.
Life in Aleppo, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Natural gas condensate. It's a mouthful of words you've probably never heard before, but we're hearing about it now because an Iranian ship carrying a million barrels of it went down off the coast of Shanghai on Sunday. More than 30 sailors are presumed dead in the disaster after a collision with another ship and a fire on board. And now an ecological disaster seems to be in the making as well. Rick Steiner is an oil spill specialist in Anchorage, Alaska. He says natural gas condensate is a kind of petroleum that behaves very differently in water than oil does.
It's very light, very explosive and volatile, and it's acutely toxic. And so on top of the human tragedy with the lost 32 crew in this disaster, we now have an environmental disaster to work with. And there's a lot we don't know about a major condensate spill. This could likely be, if it's all released, the largest condensate spill in history. And just to put it in context, if a million barrels goes into the water here or is released into the environment, which I believe is likely, the Deepwater Horizon was about 4 million barrels. Exxon Valdez was about 250,000 barrels. So this is kind of right in the middle in terms of volume.
How does natural gas condensate behave when there's a spill? I mean, how does it react with water?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's a lot we don't know about a major condensate spill, but here's what we do know. It behaves very differently than crude oil. It creates no surface slick. Containment and recovery, you know, the traditional with booms and skimmers, is really not possible. It's not as persistent as crude oil or fuel oil, but it still can persist for months in a toxic plume underwater.
How big is the affected area?
The Chinese government now is reporting 20, 30, 40, 50 square miles of sea surface affected. But I believe much of that is the fuel oil from the tanker, which is this heavy bunker sea fuel oil, which does float to the surface. But the much larger concern is the subsurface, out of sight, toxic hydrocarbon plume from the dissolved condensate, which I'm sure by now, over the past week of water currents dispersing it, has spread over hundreds of square miles of the East China Sea. And again, that's out of sight, beneath the sea surface. You can't see it, but you have to have an adequate water sampling, hydrocarbon sampling program, current modeling, plume trajectory modeling program to understand where that toxic plume is spreading.
What could it do to the environment? I mean, what's the worst case scenario?
Well, certainly those organisms that are exposed to this toxic plume, depending on the concentration of the hydrocarbons when they are exposed, could die very quickly. They could suffer, more likely suffer, sublethal impacts such as physiological impairment, reproductive impairment. This stuff includes benzene, which we know is carcinogenic. This is pretty nasty chemical that we're spilling tens of thousands of tons into a productive offshore marine environment.
When you say organisms, you're talking fish?
Everything, from zooplankton all the way up to fish, many seabirds at the surface, and also marine mammals. We know several whale species inhabit this area, porpoises. There's seals closer to shore.
And are these fishing waters? So people are relying on this area for what they're eating?
Absolutely. Well, it's a major commercial fishery offshore. There are something like 200 different species of fish are harvested by the fishing industries in this region, including croaker and pomfrey and mackerel and herring, shrimp and crab and cuttlefish and squid. It's a very productive fishery, and that is all at least impacted to some extent by this subsurface toxic plume. And we need to have an adequate comprehensive sampling program out there to understand what happens here. And I would offer this respectful criticism of the governments in the region that they have been slow to respond to get a comprehensive environmental monitoring program offshore to understand the unique impacts of this thing.
Rick Steiner, an oil spill expert based in Anchorage, Alaska, speaking to us about the sinking of an Iranian tanker off the coast of China this weekend. Bear hunting was once the definition of manhood, in some circles anyway. Think of President Teddy Roosevelt. It's still done, but in many places, public sentiment has largely turned against it. One of the latest examples is British Columbia. The Canadian province recently banned hunting for grizzly bears in a huge area known as the Great Bear Rainforest. And in its place, local First Nations, or Indigenous Canadians, are building a different kind of economy around the grizzlies. Here's reporter Irina Zhorov.
Okay, everyone's going to have to be real quiet because the bear's right in front of the tower. So I'll just go real close together, single file, and quietly.
Guide Sean O'Connor ushers a group of tourists from a bus toward a wildlife viewing tower on a recent evening in the Great Bear Rainforest in British Columbia. We're whispering to not disturb a nearby bear.
We're by the side of a river, and there's just a huge grizzly walking around. He's getting up on his legs.
We walk up onto the platform. Something smells terrible.
See all the salmon along the shores.
Salmon swim up this river, spawn in its gravel beds, and then die.
The bears will just go by and they'll just eat the skin, eat the brains, eat the roe, and they'll leave all the flesh. That's what that smell is. You didn't step in anything.
We watch the bear from the safety of the tower. But soon, he sniffs us out and runs off into the darkness. As of late last year, shooting grizzlies with cameras is the only kind of grizzly bear hunting allowed in the Great Bear Rainforest. First Nations communities in this vast tract of pristine rainforest along the western coast of Canada had fought the hunt for years, and the ban by the BC government was a big victory for Indigenous law and practices.
People a long time ago had to learn to live with bears and share the same estuaries, share the rivers. You know, a lot of the same foods we eat are very similar.
Doug Nieslas is the chief counselor of the Kitisu Heihes.
And we're taught very young to have a respect for these bears. And in one of our bear stories, we actually, the bears have the ability to take off the fur and become human.
Nieslas says his people used to hunt grizzlies for food, but stopped doing that a century ago. Today, the idea is to build a tourism economy in a way that honors the bears, benefits the First Nations, and takes into account their cultural heritage. Already, ecotourism companies run by First Nations, like the Kitisu Heihes and Hamalco Nation, bring in about 12 times more money than the trophy hunt. It's also helped local young people reconnect with their land, their songs, and dances.
And there's a lot of sense of pride that comes from that.
Speaking at an interpretive center at Homolco Nation's bear viewing camp, former chief Marianne Ennevoldsen says a friend recently brought her the paws of a grizzly killed by another bear during mating season.
He remembered me telling him that I'm going to be, you know, bringing all my traditions and cultures back, so he took the paws for me and brought them to me.
Ennevoldsen kept the paws on ice and asked all the local elders to bring their young grandkids to a special ceremony.
So I just called the grandparents and said, I've got the bear paws. I know how to do the ceremony. We don't have a longhouse yet, but let's just get together and do it.
Ennevoldsen says the community gathered for a potluck lunch and drumming songs. Then she rubbed the bear paws on the children's hands so they would harvest berries quickly, like a bear, and on their feet so they would move quietly through the forest.
I had not one elder with a dry. They were all in tears to see this. Like, they said, I can't believe, like, this is happening in our community again.
But Ennevoldsen says a resurgent local culture and successful ecotourism can't coexist with hunting. That's why some First Nations are now broadening their fight beyond grizzlies. There are other bears here, too. Population of black bears with a recessive gene that sometimes produces unique all-white offspring, known as spirit bears. The spirit bears are also protected from hunting, but the black bears that might carry the recessive genes aren't. Doug Nieslaw says the black bears should be protected next. He says that's more compatible with their beliefs and their investment in tourism.
This is the future of our community, and this is going to be, I think, the future of the Great Bear Rainforest.
The morning after watching the grizzly and the salmon stream, we venture out again. As we drive along, there are grizzlies everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
That's a big one.
Oh, yeah.
We arrive at another platform perched on the edge of another river. One giant grizzly lumbers into a silver platoon of salmon trying to swim upriver. Another fishes upstream. We snap photos. Marianne Ennevoldsen looks on, pleased with the growing success of the bear viewing business and the successful end of the fight against grizzly hunting.
It just reassures me that we're taking the right steps to look after the resources, and we've got to make sure these bears are here for generations to come.
For The World, Irina Zhorov, Orford Bay, British Columbia.
Irina's report was supported by the Institute for Journalism and Natural Resources. On to Syria now. Few reporters have followed events in that war-ravaged country as closely as our BBC colleague Lise Doucette. She's managed to get into Syria many times over the past few years, and her reporting from the besieged city of Aleppo has been especially heart-wrenching. Lise recently returned from another visit to the city.
It's been a little more than a year now since the intense last battles for the city of Aleppo, the great city of Aleppo, ended. And the skies are overcast today, grey clouds, a bit of sun peeking through. But what's not in the skies is the warplanes we heard night after night and during the day in December of 2016. You don't hear the sounds of explosions. There aren't the huge waves of people on the run fleeing the fighting. So Aleppo feels a lot calmer. But how different is it? Well, I'm here to speak to two young people I met on my last visit to Aleppo. There's Basma and Yasser. It's very nice to see you again.
Yes, nice to meet you again in different circumstances.
I have to say that your face tells me something, even just your face. You're smiling, you seem much more relaxed. How does it feel now?
We're getting to live a bit of a normal life. Like, for example, now I can go to the movies. Yeah, which was one of my favorite things to do, but I couldn't. But now I go regularly on a weekly basis.
What kind of movies are playing in Aleppo?
Last week, it was The Greatest Showman. It was Hugh Jackman. I like him so much, so.
So that's actually a new release. That's
a new release,
yes.
Yeah, exactly.
And what about you, Yasser? I mean, when we met, you know, the worry crossed your face. We could feel it. Some of your family was still in East Aleppo, and those were the last of the rebel-held areas which were coming back under government control. So that was the focus of the fighting. You two now look much more relaxed. How does the city feel for you?
Actually, last year is not comparable to this year. We have too many things, like good things, happy things. The first thing, for example, my brother could escape out the conflicts in the city at that time. Now he is living here with us. Second thing is that now I have a new son. This is the first time for me. It's like a new life for me and my family. It's a new happiness, new phase of the life. Now we are living in a much quieter city comparing to the before. We have more, safety. Still there are risks, but still we have at least some moments that we can go out without the fear of like the shilling that every now and then that we used to have last year.
And what about for you, Basaba, when a fabric is ripped, in this case in Aleppo, the social fabric has been ripped, how hard will it be to actually stitch it back together again?
It depends on the person, and I need to share with you some things I notice generally, that women outnumber the men.
That means more that a lot of the men have fled or died, and so most families are now headed by women, dominated by the women?
Exactly, yes.
And what about for you, Yasser? You told us last time we met that a lot of your family had left the country. Do they talk about coming back?
Yeah, actually, really, exactly. Last week, I was talking to my brother. He is planning to get back. We have a building of 10 apartments for my brothers and sisters. So now we are repairing this building. My brother last week was discussing with me how he would get back to Aleppo.
He's in Europe or in Turkey? Where is he?
He's in Turkey, still in Turkey, and he's planning to get back. With also, my sister is planning to get back. You know, there are too many difficulties, but despite that, they are thinking seriously to get back to Aleppo.
And Basma, when we last met, you said one of the things you wanted to do when the fighting ends was that you wanted to go to the ancient citadel of Aleppo, World Heritage Site that was very much the focus of fighting. So it was off limits to anyone to visit. Have you been to the citadel?
Let me tell you about the first time we went there. We were all in tears. We went into the citadel. And it was like every step brought up memories, brought up people who we don't see anymore, brought up, you know, scenes from the old peaceful life. So it was hard of us. We could not look at in each other's eyes because we knew how it felt. I remember when we went outside, that was there was this street vendor selling pies, local pies. And he was, you know, decorating his cart with the flowers and thing. So we all bought from him. That moment, I felt peaceful.
Basma and Yasser speaking with the BBC's Lise Doucette in Aleppo. Shock. Outrage. Those are the widespread responses to the language President Trump reportedly used in a White House meeting last week to refer to a number of predominantly Black and Hispanic countries. The president and some of his allies who were there say he didn't say those things, but a pair of senators who were also there insist that he did. The reported comments have been widely denounced as vulgar and racist. Another word that's been invoked a lot is surprise. Surprise that a president of the United States could use such derogatory language. But Julio Ricardo Varela was not surprised, and he says a lot of communities in the U.S. weren't either. Varela is the co-host of the podcast In the Thick and senior digital editor of LatinoUSA.org. He recently wrote a piece about Trump and racism for NBC's Think. Julio, we tend to go in cycles with this. Trump makes an offensive remark, people react, and then it's eventually overshadowed by his next outrageous remark. Does this surprise you anymore?
No, because he just explained it. It's become the pattern. And what he said in 2015 in June, the day he announced his intent to become president, the whole Mexican are rapists and they don't send their very best. And of course, I'm paraphrasing it now, but he said it then. And I'll tell you, the moment that happened, as a journalist, as someone who covers the Latino community, who's been covering politics for a couple of years, I just remember getting all these texts from journalists and from community leaders, both on the right and on the left, who were Latino, who were saying, did you just hear what he said? Are you kidding me? This is how this person is running this campaign. And so the reaction to people in my world was incredibly visceral. But what I remember at the time, like I say in my piece, it was kind of like, oh, look at Trump being Trump. His campaign's not going to last. When you start basing an entire campaign on a xenophobic, racist lie about a community, why are we surprised 3 years from now that he's saying the same thing over and over again, and we're still getting into this analysis, is he racist, is he not racist, when we all know the answer to it?
I was interested in your piece where you mentioned that past presidents, both Democrat and Republican, have helped create the basis for Trump's immigration policy. What do you mean by that?
You cannot have Donald Trump without Bill Clinton, George Bush, or Barack Obama. And I think one of the things that people don't remember or maybe have selective memory, the State of the Union address, I believe it was in 1995 or 96, Bill Clinton basically said some of the same things that Donald Trump has said in terms of calling people illegal aliens, saying that they're stealing our jobs and that we have to be tough on border security. And Bill Clinton actually ran in 1996 a political ad against Bob Dole saying that Bill Clinton deported more people than any other president in history. So you cannot have someone like Donald Trump unless you have someone like Bill Clinton. And then with George Bush, I make mention of the fact that he sent the National Guard to the border, which was seen at the time by a lot of people in the community as being a little bit over the top. And then Barack Obama, who in essence has deported more people than any other president in the history of this country. And that was a very uncomfortable truth when it came to Democrats. Trump takes it up to 11, but you couldn't have it if you didn't have the three presidents before them.
So you're saying that at some level, an anti-immigrant stance appeals to a wide variety of Americans and presidents from both sides of the aisle. You use that to gain support.
Absolutely. And, you know, when I say that, people think I'm crazy. But you talk to a lot of people in the Latino community about the Clinton years. They weren't so great when it comes to immigration. And we need to be really truthful with ourselves and stop romanticizing certain presidencies. Now, did Barack Obama change his positions in the last couple of years of his administration? Yes. But we cannot run away from the fact that this DREAM Act that is now being discussed during this government shutdown didn't pass in 2010, and that was a Democratic majority. And then you wonder why we are here in 2018. Democrats, as much as they're fighting for it now, have lacked the spine just as much as Republicans.
But couldn't you argue that it's a good thing that people have reacted so strongly to Trump's alleged remarks, that there is a limit to what people are willing to take, and that that reaction has to some degree been bipartisan?
Yes, but where was everyone when the same things were happening in 2011, 2012? Where was the outrage then? I can point to deportation cases of families being separated then that didn't make the front cover of newspapers. Now people care about it. But this issue's been an issue for close to 20 years. And yes, I do think the country is now finally coming to terms with it. But let's not pretend that this just happened in 2015 when Trump called Mexican rapists. I mean, it's really easy to call Trump a racist, but that debate ended 3 years ago. There needs to be a bigger, more serious conversation on how we look at immigration in this country and understand that we've led ourselves to this path. It's an ugly path. And we as Americans have to come to terms with that.
Julio Ricardo Varela, co-host of the podcast In the Thick. He's a senior digital editor at LatinoUSA.org. Thanks, Julio.
Thank you.
Finally today, you might not remember her name, but you might well remember her voice. Dolores O'Riordan. She was the lead singer of the Irish band The Cranberries, and she had this unforgettable voice.
Do you get that a lot? Everyone loves your voice?
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's always been about the best virtue, the big virtue I've always had, like your voice. So.
You've been singing a long time?
Yes, there's about five.
That was O'Riordan speaking with TV host Craig Kilborn back in the late 90s. O'Riordan died yesterday of undisclosed causes. She grew up near Limerick, Ireland, and she was just 18 when her band broke out. This song, Zombie, rose up the charts all over the world. It hit number one in the U.S. in 1994. It's an earworm you can't get out of your head, literally. O'Riordan was inspired to write the song by an infamous event.
The town center was packed with thousands of shoppers when the first of the two bombs exploded just before 12:30.
In March 1993, the IRA planted two bombs in Warrington, England.
The bombs had exploded inside metal waste bins, and many people running from the first explosion were caught by the blast of the second less than a minute later.
Two children were killed. More than 50 people were seriously injured. O'Riordan heard the news while she was on tour, and she wrote Zombie as a protest anthem. It's a tough thing to sing about, she said in an interview online. But when you're young, you don't think twice about things. You just grab it and do it. It's the same old thing since 1916, the lyrics go, referencing the Easter Rising, the Irish rebellion against British rule. In your head, they're still fighting. With their tanks and their bombs and their bombs and their guns. In your head, they are dying. Dolores O'Riordan was 46 years old. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for listening. Marco Werman's back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.